everybody. My name is Arya Sikrin, as was mentioned. I'm from California originally, now living in Miami. And spent several years here back about 12 years ago, and I'm here to visit my in-laws and happy to be able to teach some Torah while I'm here. Just to explain what a siyum actually is, a siyum is a completion of a tractate or a holy book in the Torah. And traditionally, when one completes the study of such a book, one makes a little celebration, a little party. And this is a time of year that is customary to make such siyumim and such parties, because traditionally this is the saddest part of the Jewish calendar. We are approaching the saddest day of the year, which is the ninth day of Av, which is the day that both holy temples in Jerusalem were destroyed, first by the Babylonians and the second by the Romans. And therefore there are many traditional customs in this time that have to do with mourning. People don't eat meat or drink wine, buy new things, and so on and so forth. But of course, we don't like being sad. We like being happy. It's always better to be happy and joyful and have a good outlook on life in terms of serving God and being friendly with people and so on. So we look for ways at this time to increase joy in a permissible way. And one of those ways is by studying Torah, extra Torah, and in fact completing study of Torah, which is a good activity all the time, and especially now to increase in permissible joy. So I'm going to complete the tractate called Midos, which is the section in the Talmud that talks about the measurements of the Holy Temple, which is also a good topic for this time. And after I complete it, I'll go back and mention one of the measurements of the Mizbeach of the Holy Altar, and from there it will take us into the topic of today's class. So the final Mishnah in that tractate talks about the Sanhedrin. That was the highest court in the land, and one of their jobs was to ascertain the Kohanim, to make sure the Kohanim all had the right lineage. Nowadays you can just go into a doctor's office and get a gene testing. If you have the Cohen gene, you're a Cohen. If not, not. I'm just kidding, actually. That's one, you know, one of the newest things, but that's actually not something that's enough to establish if you're a Cohen. A Cohen has to be a descendant of Aaron on his father's father's side and so on. And there are certain restrictions of who a Cohen can marry. And if a Cohen marries a woman he's not supposed to marry, the children are not considered Cohenim. So when they built the second temple, they had a whole group of Kohanim, Levim, the Levites, and so on. And not everybody was allowed to go up and serve in that temple unless they had a writ and a document that documented their family back to a Kohen who had served on the altar. Any Kohen who had served on the altar in the Holy Temple, you knew that he was good, that he was checked out. The Sanhedrin, the highest court, would always check them out. So they checked out all the families, and there was one family that was not accepted because they had married into a family that there was a question about the lineage, and they were exiled from acting as Kohanim in the Holy Temple. They were not completely not Kohanim, they were kind of in the status of a doubt, but in any case, this was one of the jobs of the Sanhedrin of the highest court, to establish who was a Kohen and who was not. So the Mishnah reads that if they would find that a Kohen was a valid Kohen, v'shalo nimtza boi psul, if a Kohen was found not to have any blemish, meaning to say anything invalid in his family, loivesh levanim umesatef levanim, he would dress in white and put on a white hat, which was a sign of gladness and so on, nichnas umeshamesh im echav hakohenim, then he would go out and serves with the, or he would enter actually, and serve with his brothers, the Kohanim, the fellow Kohanim. The Yamtafayu Oysim, Shulimimtsa Psul Bazar Shal Aron HaKohen, they would make a Yamtaf, they would make a joyful event out of the fact that a Kohen was found to be kosher. The Kachayu Oysim, this is what they would say, Baruch HaMokam, Baruch Hu, blessed be Hashem, Shulimimtsa Psul Bazar Shal Aron, that no disqualification was found in the seed of Aaron. Baruch Hu, blessed is he, shebocher ba'aron ubebonav, that he chose Aaron and his sons, that God chose Aaron and his sons, lamed l'sharas lifnei Hashem beveish kodesh hakodashim, to serve in front of God in the house of the Holy of Holies. And that completes this tractate. Just to go back to something mentioned earlier in this tractate, and then to go on to the topic of halachic myths. Topic of halachic myths is about preconceived notions. You know, you have a certain understanding of something, maybe you heard it from somebody, maybe you heard it from somebody trustworthy, and so on. But sometimes those things can be mistaken. And sometimes it pays to look into matters and find out that things might be different than the way they appear. So in the first temple, the altar was actually four amot, four cubits. A cubit is about a foot and a half. What is that in meters? I'm not even sure. Half a meter. So it was smaller by four cubits to the west and the north than in the second temple. And why is that? Because they had to pour water and wine on the holy altar, and that had to go into the earth, and there was a tube that was dug by King David that went all the way deep, deep into the depths of the earth. It went so deep that when he dug that that tube, it was a flood water that threatened to come up and flood the whole world. So they didn't want to build the altar on top of those holes, because it says in the verse Mizbach Adama that the holy altar had to be an altar of earth, which they believed meant it had to be built on top of earth with no holes in between. So they therefore had these holes on the side of the altar. They didn't build the altar all the way into the holes. When they came back and they came to build the second temple was, of course, not as great as the first temple. The first temple was built by the righteous King Solomon, and it was built at the height of the Jewish people's power. The second temple was built by, you know, 20,000 and change people who were allowed to come back and build a temple by the first the King Cyrus and then the King Darius. And they were poor. They built a small building. The elders who were there and had seen the first temple were crying. As everybody else was celebrating, they were crying because they were comparing this temple to the first temple. Yet at the same time, they tried to improve as much as they could. And they came to the conclusion that the holy altar should be expanded to actually include that space, because they said just like the what is burned on the holy altar is on the altar itself, so what should be poured, the liquids that are poured, which was water and wine, should also be poured on the altar itself and not on the side. And therefore they expanded it, and they reinterpreted the other verse about the Mizbach Adama, the altar of earth, to mean that it had to be connected to the ground. It couldn't be built on top of a pillar or on top of a dome or anything like that. But nevertheless, the point is that they didn't say, well, this is the way it was done, and it was this way for 410 years. King Solomon made it. All the prophets saw it. Nobody thought to make it any better. And therefore, we're not even going to think. We're just going to do it. They didn't have that attitude. They had the attitude that we're going to look into it. We're going to see. If there's a way to make it better, we're going to make it better. So that leads us on to the topic of this talk, halachic myths. Now, one has to be careful when it comes to debunking halachic myths, because there's an interesting responsa of the Rashba, a great sage, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderes, 13th century, I believe. And he writes that any custom that the Jewish people have, even a custom of old women, meaning to say one that we don't know exactly where it comes from, people do it, like they say, a baba maisa. You know, that's what old women say, but nobody knows where it comes from. The Rashba says, no, it's not simple. If Jewish people do it, there's a reason for it. Don't make fun of it, and don't stop doing it. He says, for example, why do women wave their hands over the candles when they make the blessing on Friday night? Nobody knows. Nobody knows exactly why, but everybody does it. And there must be a reason for it, and they should continue doing it. Of course, people do give some explanations why, but nevertheless, he doesn't dispel it. He doesn't say, well, it doesn't say it in the Talmud, doesn't say it in the Medrash, it doesn't come from anywhere, stop doing it. He doesn't say that. He says if people do it, there's something to that. So therefore, it is hard to dispel halachic myths. But nevertheless, some of them, it says clearly, are actually myths and are mistakes that people have made, and therefore they can be dispelled. And some of them, we cannot dispel them. We can just say, you know, maybe there's something to it, but we don't know exactly where it's from. Can I just have one handout? Because I'm not sure. Okay, so I'm not going to go in any particular order here, but there's a famous myth, and I'm told that it even made it onto the movies, although I don't usually watch movies, and I certainly didn't watch this one, but something to do with how to kosher your knives, if your knife becomes non-kosher. This is something I heard only within the past 10 years, and when I heard it the first time I said, like, what are you talking about? So you take your knife and you put it in a flower pot and you leave it there for anywhere between 1 to 3 days and you take it out and it's kosher. Anybody heard of this myth? No, you all learn it. Very good. Well, this is I don't know where it came from, where it started, but it's been repeated and people say it, and it actually comes from two laws that are talking about different kinds of koshering, and somebody made the mistake of putting them together. Basically, when something becomes not kosher, meaning to say a utensil that is used with not kosher food, has an absorption of the taste of that non-kosher food. So it could have that absorption inside of it, because if it's used with heat, so the heat can actually cause the food to actually be absorbed by that utensil. Or it could just have some on the surface of it and it just has to be washed off. So if you have a knife that was used to cut non-kosher meat, for example, so there could be grease on the surface of that knife. And what it says in the Talmud to do in order to clean off that grease is to stick it in the ground 10 times. Remembering that they didn't used to have steel. Steel was invented in 18th century, I think. I don't know exactly. So they had thick iron knives. Iron rusts, of course. So these knives were not very easy to clean. So they, in order to get the grease off of the knives, they would have to literally stab the earth, hard earth specifically. So that abrasion, you know, the abrasiveness of going into the earth 10 times, that would clean off the grease on the knife, and you had a kosher knife. So that is one law, and that is actually correct. You can still do that today, although you don't have to do it today. You can just use an abrasive, you know, back of the sponge or a steel wool, whatever it is, Scotch-Brite, whatever it's called, and clean the knife in your sink. That's good too. But in any case, there is another law when it comes to koshering vessels, and that is, this you have to listen carefully for, When you take, let's say, a pot that became not kosher, and you want to make it kosher, or let's say a person is going kosher, you know, they have their home, the kitchen, and they're going kosher. They need to take all the utensils and make them kosher. How do you make it kosher? So you dip it in boiling water, because just like the food was absorbed into the pot through heat of water or other liquid, so that's how it, so to speak, spits out the taste. Now the problem is, when you stick it into the bigger pot that has boiling water, so the taste comes out, and it makes that water non-kosher, and then it goes back right in to where it came from. So what did you accomplish? You accomplished nothing, right? If we're assuming that there is actually non-kosher taste in this pot, right? So if it is not kosher, comes out, makes the water not kosher, and then goes back into the pot. So there's different ways of getting around that. But one of the ways is to wait 24 hours since it was used, because the flavor that is absorbed into a pot after being absorbed inside something for 24 hours, it doesn't taste good anymore. So therefore, when it goes out of the water, it's not a good taste. It does not make that water non-kosher. And then even if it goes back into the pot, it does not make that pot non-kosher. So there is the concept of waiting 24 hours before kashering a vessel. So somehow somebody put these two laws together and decided that in order to kasher a knife, you have to bury it in the earth for 24 hours. That is a mistake, and it has just been corrected. Okay. Another interesting one. I don't know if anybody's heard of this one, but this is one that I heard from my grandmother, and maybe you heard from your grandmother, and that is not to pay debts on Motzei Shabbos, not to pay back debts on Saturday night. Anybody? Maybe they have different myths in Australia than they do in America. We should have researched this. So there is a perception that some people have. They say if you give away money in the beginning of the week, the Jewish week starts, of course, on Saturday night. Shabbos is the seventh day. And when Shabbos is over, Saturday night is technically already part of Sunday on the Jewish calendar, so that's the beginning of the week. So they say they don't want to give away money in the beginning of the week because that's like a bad sign that this week they're going to have to give away a lot of money. That's what people say. And this, in fact, it says clearly in the Code of Jewish Law that this is an idolatrous practice because, you know, the idolaters used to believe, maybe some people still do believe, you know, a black cat, it walks in front of you, it means that. Walking under a ladder means something else. The 13th floor, do they have floor 13? They do. In America, you go into a building, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 12, and then 14. There's no 14th floor, because nobody wants to go on the 13th floor because it's a bad omen. What does that mean? Nobody knows. So the point is, this is one of the things that it says comes from a non-Jewish pagan source. And therefore it says one should not say this. On the other hand, if somebody believes that it's true, they are allowed to simply not pay the debt back on Saturday night. But they cannot say why they're not paying it. They have to make a different excuse. You cannot explicitly say that that's the reason. And this is actually a theme that we do find concerning a lot of these practices that have to do with omens. We don't really believe in omens, more or less, with some exceptions. But a person that believes in them is allowed to follow them, but he cannot say that he's following them. Because if you say it, you're giving it more importance than if you just kind of do it as a by the way kind of thing. So this is the case in this as well. Which brings us to the concept of magic. This is something that is quite surprising, and I would venture to guess that this is probably a mistake that some of you have made, which is magic is harmless. I mean, it's great fun, magicians, tricks, sleight of hand, it's beautiful. But actually, it is something that is forbidden by the Code of Jewish Law, simply because magic was the method that pagan priests used to use to prove their veracity or whatever, they're having some kind of supernatural powers. They used to use sleight of hand or whatever black magic is to prove that they have occult powers. And therefore, it is forbidden to practice magic even if it is sleight of hand, because it is similar to a practice that was associated with paganism. And I must say, I've been to many synagogues and, you know, Jewish events where they hire a magician to entertain the kids. Maybe the magician is not Jewish, so they don't have this prohibition, but sometimes they are Jewish. And it actually says in the Code of Jewish Law that you are not supposed to practice magic, even sleight of hand magic. Now, the only exception, of course, would be if you would show the audience, if you'd actually show them how you're doing it. But of course, the magicians have a pact between them that you're not allowed to reveal the way to do the trick. But nevertheless, other than that, it would seem to be a problem. If there's any questions, by the way, please feel free. Yes.
So does that extend to doing card tricks with your kids or something like that? If you don't give them the trick at the end of it?
I don't know. To what extent does it go? That's a good question. I'm not sure.
That sleight of hand effective.
Right. Well, you should definitely tell them that it's sleight of hand, and perhaps one day show it to them. That helps, but I'm not sure. So this brings us to the position of a bed, how a person is meant to sleep. And this is one of those myths that I cannot dispel completely, because I could not find that it specifically says that this is not true. But in all the books that I've looked at, not that I've read all the books there are to read, but I've consulted with people far more learned than myself, and they agree that it doesn't say this anywhere. There is a common saying that you should not sleep with your feet towards the door. Anybody heard of this one? Oh, thank you. So we got one. So why? Why do they say this? They say because when they take a dead body out of a room, they take them feet first. So it's, so to speak, like a bad sign to sleep with your feet towards the door. Now, there are some things that we do because they are done with dead people. For example, there's a tradition that we don't pour out of a pitcher, we don't pour backwards, because that's the way they pour when there's a ritual purification process that they do with somebody who's passed away. They pour that way, so we don't pour that way because it's just not nice. So in the same way, that's what people say about the bed. Nevertheless, this is not written in any book that I know of. In fact, when it does discuss positions of the bed, there are different opinions of how a bed of a married couple should be placed. Some say that it should not be placed east and west, because that the Shechina is in the west, so to speak, so it's improper. Some say just the opposite, it should be placed east and west and so on, because the Shechina rests on that bed and so on. So there's different opinions about that, but in that whole discussion on the Code of Jewish Law and all the commentaries, nobody says about the feet facing the door. And it seems to me, I'm not going to dispel it, because as I said, it's hard to do that, but it seems to me that it comes from some other source, a non-Jewish source, perhaps even a pagan source. Feng Shui, is that what they call it? Feng Shui, when you have all the different ways to arrange the house and so on and so forth. That's something that the Jewish religion does not believe in. So that's what it seems. Although there are some practices that we do that do have to do with spirits and dispelling bad spirits. Now, this is a very interesting one. I don't have it in the sheet here, but it's a very interesting one. There is a tradition that when you cut your nails, because nails are part of you, so, and actually nails, I should say, are also associated with the original sin, because it says that Adam and Eve, before the original sin, were covered with nails. They had like an exoskeleton, and it was like the nails we have on our fingernails and toenails, and after the sin, that was taken away. So nails are associated with some form of sinfulness, impurity, and so on. And that's why it says that the nails can actually, somebody steps on them, it can bring some kind of bad result. So you're not supposed to just cut your nails and throw them on the street. You're supposed to dispose of them properly, bury them, flush them down the toilet. Some people even burn them to make sure nobody will walk on them. So there is something to that in the Jewish tradition about bad spirits and so on. And here's a very interesting thing that is not a myth, according to some opinions. And that is, there's a particular way to cut your nails. Anybody? What's the way? Oh, very good. Very good. Alternating. So you do, if you count the thumb as number one You start on the left hand with number 4, number 2, number 5, number 3, and number 1. And on the right hand, again counting the thumb as number 1, you do number 2, number 4, number 1, number 3, number 5. Now, why do we do that? It seems very unusual. And the Arizal, who was a master Kabbalist in Sfat, would laugh at this custom. So he thought it was a myth. If he would be giving this class, he would dispel this myth. But others actually say that it's a good custom. Now, where does this custom come from? So it seems that it has to do with not cutting the nails in order, which also is not clear where that comes from. Perhaps from the Chevra Kadisha, that in the purification process of a dead body before burial, they cut it in order. So we don't want to do it that way, perhaps. But in any case, the idea of doing it in that particular order has to do with the way we light the Hanukkah menorah. Anybody? Can you get the connection? Why do we light the Hanukkah menorah the way we do? We start on the right, and then we add one, and we start with that new one, and we go left to right. And then we add another one, we start with that new one, we go left to right. Because the Talmud says that kol pinos sha'ata poina al tifna ela liyamin. When you have a choice to turn right or left, you turn right. That's what it says. In general, you turn right. When the Chazan takes the Torah out of the Holy Ark and he comes to the Bima, which is the table that he's reading it, he walks to the right. When they lift up the Torah, they wrap it up, they bring it back. Again, they walk to the right of that table towards the Holy Ark and so on. We're always turning to the right because the right, in general, in the Jewish mysticism or just perspective in general, right has to do with kindness, with holiness, and so on. Left is associated with more strength, severity, punishment. So we generally prefer the right over the left. I hope I'm not insulting any lefties, but nevertheless, actually it does say that a left hand is like their right hand. That's what it says in terms of the significance of right or left. A lefty's left is like their right. So therefore, when they wash their hands, they actually wash their left hand first. But in any case, getting back to this, so we therefore start with the right on the menorah, and when we add one, we start with the new one so that we can go towards the right. So we start with the left so we can go towards the right, and then, and so on and so forth, each one we add, we then go towards the right. So here it is. Ready? Skip one, do one, moving to the right. 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 Same thing with the thumb, and the same thing with the other hand. Skip one, skip one, skip one, skip one, skip one, and so on. And you've cut all your nails without doing any in any particular or in order, but always moving to the right. Okay. This is one that is a little bit relevant to the time that we're in. I was mentioning that we do not eat meat or drink wine during the week in the days approaching the 9th of Av, which is the day of the destruction of the Holy Temple. That is true from the 1st of Av, which was this past Monday, till the 9th of Av. Excuse me. It seems that this has led people, some people, to a misconception. People ask me all the time, in my position as a rabbi or whatever, people call me the sitting shiva. Are they allowed to drink wine? Are they allowed to eat meat? There's a perception people think if they're sitting shiva that there is a problem with eating meat and drinking wine. In fact, there is no problem. When a person is an oinen, God forbid, meaning to say, if a close relative has passed away before they are buried, it is inappropriate to eat meat or drink wine because it's just not right when you should be busy taking care of the funeral arrangements to be sitting down and having such a good time. But afterwards, it is permissible. In fact, in the Talmud it says that the mourner should not drink more than how many cups of wine? Guess? 10 cups, not more than 10. Remembering that in ancient times, they didn't always have fresh water. And standing water can go bad, can get bacteria and all kinds of things. So they used to have a fermented liquid, beer or wine or something of that sort, to drink on a regular basis. There wasn't much options. They didn't have juice, milk, all this stuff they didn't have. So it was considered normal to drink wine with every meal. I think they still do that in France, actually. And therefore, you wouldn't tell him not to drink wine, but he shouldn't have more than 10 cups, because then he'll get drunk, and then it would not be appropriate. So the reason why we don't have meat or wine in the 9 days is not just because of the general sadness of this period, like I was mentioning, but it's also because we are commemorating the fact that we don't have the sacrifices in the Holy Temple, which included meat and wine. They used to pour the wine on the altar as well. So we remember that by refraining from having these things. But actually, a mourner is able to have these things. Okay, a little bit about the laws of kashering. We were mentioning it earlier, and this is a mistake that is worth correcting. People, if a person who keeps kosher mistakenly cooks their dinner, lunch, or whatever it is, in the wrong kind of utensil. Part of keeping kosher is to keep meat and milk separate. The Torah says, do not cook a kid goat in its mother's milk. And the rabbis understood that to mean not just not cooking, but not eating. So you don't cook them together, you don't eat them together, and so on. So there's separate cutlery, separate dishes, separate pots, separate pans, and everything. But mistakes happen. People make mistakes. What do you do if you made a mistake? You made your omelet in your what's called a fleishik frying pan, your meat frying pan, or vice versa. So often, the people that call me will say, I already threw out the omelet, what do I do about the pan? So I'm going to save you from having to throw out any omelets in the future by sharing with you that based on what we learned earlier, we said that the taste that is inside a pot or a utensil, after 24 hours, it is said to have lost its good taste. It's already a bad taste. So even though in the first place we wouldn't tell you to mix up the meat and the dairy side, we would tell you to always keep it separate, but after the fact, if you did use a pan that had not been used in 24 hours, and if you're not sure, you can assume it hadn't been used in 24 hours, that's the presumption. So the food that was cooked is considered kosher. And the pan, of course, has to be kashered and so on. That's a separate issue. Like I said, you can dip it in boiling water, and that takes care of that. Okay. Okay, this is another interesting one. This may not seem so relevant if you're not yet observant of the laws of Shabbat, but nevertheless, it's good to learn about. On Shabbat, on the seventh day, we are not supposed to do work. That is, of course, because God created the world on the 6 days, and he rested on Shabbat, and therefore, we should emulate that and not work on Shabbat. And in fact, it says in the Talmud that by keeping Shabbat, we become partners with God in creation, because he created the world, but who knows that he created the world? We, the Jewish people, were commissioned to tell the world about his having created the world. And by observing that day, we are announcing to the world, we believe this is correct, this is true, that it's a special day. Of course, a person could say, well, I don't even have to keep it. I'm just going to put up a sign that says, I believe. I'll put up a bumper sticker. I believe in God. I believe in the 7 days of creation. But that's not it, because a person who truly believes acts on that belief. And if you just say it, but you don't act on it, then it's not real. So the point is, to be a partner with God in creation is not just to tell people about God and his creation, but to act in accordance with it. And that's the importance of observing the Shabbat and not going to work and not even doing work in one's home and so on. Now, what people have done, you know, over the centuries, and oftentimes in a mistaken way, is to think that they can have a non-Jew do the work for them on the seventh day, on Shabbat, and they're good, because of course the non-Jewish people do not have to observe that day, even though it's in the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were given to the Jewish people. Now, many of them contain universal messages which everybody can learn from and observe, but nevertheless not all of them are necessary for non-Jews to observe, and one of those is of course observing Shabbat. So a person can say, I have a non-Jewish cleaner who comes and does work for me, so I'll have them do whatever it is that needs to be done on Shabbat. So in fact this is forbidden, because the sages said that if you were to do that, then Shabbat would become like a regular day. You know, everything, you know, you'd have your business working, you'd have your home, you know, being operated in a normal way, and you would hire people to do it for you, and you would be missing out on the sanctity of Shabbat and feeling that it's a different day and experiencing the communion with the Creator. Of course, the purpose of Shabbat is not just not to work, but in fact to have a more elevating spiritual day and to actually forget about doing work. So that's why one cannot hire a non-Jewish person to do work for them on Shabbat. Now, there is an exception, and that is if they do the work for themselves, you can benefit from that, because they're not doing it for you specifically. So if they come into a room and they turn the lights on, okay, you can read by that light, because they didn't do it for you. Okay, now here's where the myth comes in. So a person might think, you know, since they, let's say they heated up some hot water to make coffee, they did it for themselves. So I'm going to take the rest of that water and I'll use it for myself. That's actually not correct. That's forbidden. Because the next week, when they're making coffee, they're going to add more for you to have your coffee, because they know that that's what happened last week. Even if it's somebody that you never met before, and you're never going to meet again, you're passing through, you're in a hotel, you say, well, the coffee pot is there, you know, they didn't make it for me, it doesn't make a difference. Because if you benefit from something that can be added to, then there is a decree that you cannot benefit, because next time they might add. So if it's something that is, the Talmud says, ner le'echad, ner le'meya, one candle is enough light for one person, and it's enough light for 100 people. So if they turn the light on, it's good enough. They don't have to add any extra light for anybody else. You can benefit from it. But when it comes to something that is like food, which is in quantities, certain quantities, that you should not benefit from. So that is another myth. Yes.
After Shabbat lunch, that happens a bit.
Right. Okay, this is a good point. So what you are allowed to do is have somebody, you can pay somebody, not on Shabbat, but you can hire them to do work for you that you yourself are allowed to do. So any kind of cleanup that is permissible for you to do on Shabbat, you can pay somebody to do, even if they're Jewish or non-Jewish. You know, you go to an event and you have waiters serving, whatever it is, not desecrating the Shabbat, but they're going to be paid for their work after Shabbat. There's a way how they have to be paid together with weekday work. That's a whole other story. But the point is that's permissible. Now, when you hire them to wash the dishes, now the way that a person who is Shabbat observant would wash the dishes would be different than a person who is not Shabbat observant, or than the way they do it during the week. You're not supposed to use hot water, not supposed to use a sponge and so on, but there's a way to do it. So when they're doing it, you don't have to tell them how to do it, because you're not telling them to do work on Shabbat. You're telling them to do something that's permissible. They're choosing to do it in the way they're choosing. Now, a dishwasher is a little bit of an issue because a dishwasher makes noise, so to speak, meaning to say somebody who's passing by might hear that and might say, hey, what's going on? You're not supposed to do that on Shabbat and so on. The same thing with a vacuum cleaner. You could say, well, they can sweep. They may as well use the vacuum cleaner. That's more of a question because the noise of it elicits suspicion, and it's not good for your reputation. And also for people, you know, thinking that Shabbat is not so important. But something like washing the dishes, where really there's different ways of doing it, you don't have to tell them specifically how to do it. Yes?
I'm not yet Jewish.
Uh-huh.
I asked to write my number on Shabbat.
Uh-huh. That's an interesting question. Who asked you?
A Jewish person.
Better not. It's better not. They really shouldn't ask. You know, if you do it on your own, that's up to you. You know, these laws don't yet apply to you. But if they shouldn't really be asking. Here's the thing. There are ways to ask it. This is already a loophole. We're getting into murky waters. There are ways to ask it in a way that it should not be a direct request. In other words, if they would say, you know, if I would have your number, I would call you. And then you write your number, and then you give it to them, so they didn't tell you to do it. So that is something that would be permissible. But even that, I'll just say, I just want to clarify, even that is not permissible if it's something that one is going to get benefit from immediately. In other words, in the case of the number, they're not going to need it until after Shabbat, so there's no immediate benefit. But if it's something like a light or like food or something like that, so because it's more clear and evident that they're doing it for you, so one should not say it even in a way of a hint. You know, like if the light were on, it would be great. Right? Unless the person, the non-Jewish person, is going to benefit from that light, then it's okay, like we mentioned earlier. But if it's just for the Jewish person, since it's an immediate benefit, it should not be said. Yes.
How about with air conditioning or heating in a
shul? So actually, this is where the original Shabbos Goy came from. I don't mean to be offensive in any way, but the word Goy means a non-Jew. You know, it means a member of another nation. So there's something called the Shabbos Goy, a Gentile that is hired for Shabbat in order to do what the Jews need them to do. Now, the original Shabbos Goy was commissioned by the Jews in the shtetl to heat their ovens, because in the winter it would get very cold, and it was literally dangerous, the levels of cold, especially for young kids, and it was considered permissible to specifically tell him to light the oven because of the danger either of actual death or even not, simply of sickness. That's also enough to warrant that it should be permissible to tell him. So they used to have people specifically for that task. And it seems that over the centuries, you know, they would borrow them for other tasks as well, sometimes in a permissible way and sometimes not so. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was a great rabbi originally from Europe and then in America, passed away about 20 years ago, more about 25. So he said that in a place where it's extremely hot, it's the same as a place where it's extremely cold. In other words, just like a person can get sick from being too cold, a person can get sick from being too hot, and therefore it would be permissible to have a non-Jew turn on the air conditioning if it got to any extreme kind of temperature. Now, if it's not an extreme temperature, it's just an uncomfortable temperature, then you have to look for other loopholes, which are a little bit involved, so we won't get into them now. But depending on the situation, there might be room for the loophole. But the most obvious one is if it's going to be an extreme heat.
So even if it's a direct benefit, if you hint and you don't say directly?
I wouldn't say it's okay blanket, but it really depends on the level of work. See, because electricity, there's a question, what is electricity? I mean, electricity is the movement of electrons and so on, but what is it in terms of work on Shabbat? Where does it fall into the categories of work on Shabbat? In the Talmud, it says there are 39 kinds of permissible labors on Shabbat, and electricity is not one of them. There was no word for electricity. It didn't exist at that time that they knew of. So how do we know that it's forbidden to use electricity on Shabbat? And there's different opinions whether it's actually forbidden on a biblical level at all, or perhaps it's only forbidden on a rabbinic level. Now, if you're using the electricity to turn on an oven, which is going to cook, so that is a Torah-level violation in any case, because cooking is the violation regardless of whether you're using coal or gas or electricity, right? Because it's the act of cooking. But if you're just using the electricity without doing another kind of work, like an air conditioning, is cooling a room. Cooling a room is not forbidden. You could bring ice buckets into a room and cool it on Shabbat. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But it's the fact that using electricity, some say that that is only a rabbinic prohibition. And once it's rabbinic, and the whole idea of not having a non-Jew work is also rabbinic, so it's a double rabbinic law, it's not as strict, and therefore in cases of need, cases of financial loss, cases of a mitzvah, in order to be able to do a mitzvah, there is room for leniency in that case. So I hope I'm not building any new myths. I hope I'm just keeping it straightforward.
Like, if you don't want to turn on the air conditioning or whatever, a child under 3 years old, is that a myth that a 2-year-old can go and turn on the air conditioner if you want?
Okay, so here's what it says about children. First of all, the age of educating children is for each and every mitzvah, each and every law of the Torah, according to the understanding of the child. Meaning to say, when the child understands the idea of tzitzit, right, to remind us of the mitzvot, and they're old enough to wear it properly without getting it dirty, to keep 2 on the right, 2 on the left, to hold it in their hands when they say the Shema in the morning. When they reach that age, you have to educate them to wear tzitzit. When they know how to hold the lulav and etrog, those are the 4 species that we wave on the holiday of Sukkot. When they're old enough to know how to wave it, right, left, up, down, back, whatever, that's the age for that. When it comes to things that they're not allowed to do, you have to train them from the age that they understand the word no. Because no is the same for all things that are forbidden, right? So once they're able to understand that, of course, a 2-year-old thinks no means yes. So we're not talking about that. But when they are old enough to understand that no means no, you should already start training them to not do things that are forbidden. Now, so if the child is already the age of being educated in that, then that should not be done at all, right? But if the child is beneath that age, you know, 1, 1.5, 2, you know, 3 is already iffy. So then what it says is that if it's a case that it would be permissible to ask a Gentile, then in general you should ask a Gentile, even in such a case, because we don't want the child to get used to doing this on Shabbat. Right, the Gentile doesn't have to ever keep Shabbat ever, right, if they convert to something else, but as far as we know, they're not. So they don't have to get used to it, but the child has to get used to it. So therefore, we prefer to use a Gentile in that case. But if there is no Gentile available, and it's something important, and it falls into the category of something that would be permissible to ask a Gentile to do, then you can not tell them, but kind of hint to them in the same way. You know, put them in front of the light switch or whatever and let them play around. So, we running out of time? No? We have a few more minutes? Okay, so this is something interesting. Inviting a non-Jew to one's Pesach Seder. May one invite a non-Jew to their Pesach Seder? Anybody?
I've done it.
You've done it? Okay. So, again, I don't know, I guess the myths of America have not reached Australia, but this is something that has been asked over and over again. And people are under the impression that it is forbidden to have a non-Jew at the Seder. And the reason for that mistake is because it says in the Torah that a non-Jew cannot eat from the Paschal lamb. They had a sacrifice that they brought once a year. This was one sacrifice that actually every Jew had to participate in. Excuse me, people ask about being vegetarian, if being vegetarian is permissible according to the Torah. The answer is, nowadays, if you want to be vegetarian, it's permissible. There's no problem. But in the times of the Holy Temple, which we're hoping will be rebuilt and so on, once a year you had to eat meat. Every Jew, man, woman, and child that was of age to be educated, would have to eat at least one portion of the Paschal lamb. And that lamb was, of course, burned on the day before Pesach and eaten at the Pesach Seder, and it was a symbol that we were freed from the Egyptians, who actually worshipped the lamb, and by our sacrificing it, we were renouncing our belief in that idol, and instead, turning our worship towards God. So because that is really what, it's an event that happened at the very beginning of the Jewish people, when the Jewish people were coming into existence. It's what separated us from the rest of the world, and therefore it is considered improper for us to share that sacrifice with a person who was not Jewish. That's what it says in the Torah, a non-Jewish person cannot eat from the Paschal lamb. So people kind of think that the same thing should apply to a Seder, but in fact we do not have the Paschal lamb by a Seder. It's forbidden, in fact, to have a roast lamb at the Seder, and some say it's forbidden to have any roast meat at the Seder because you're not supposed to make people think that you have the Paschal lamb because, of course, we don't have the Holy Temple and so on. So, therefore, this particular law does not apply. That being said, there is a more general problem because on the holiday, in general, one is actually not supposed to do work. And it is only permissible to cook for a person who is observant, or a Jewish person who is supposed to be observant of that particular holiday. In other words, on Shabbat, we don't cook at all. On a holiday, it is permissible to cook, because otherwise, how are we going to be able to live? If it's a holiday, if it's Shabbat, 2 days, sometimes even 3 days. So the Torah said, for the purpose of cooking, you are allowed. However, that permission was only extended for somebody who was observant of that holiday. A person who is not observant, they can cook for themselves. So we don't allow this override of the laws of the holiday to take effect. And that is the only problem with having a non-Jew at the Seder. So it's not a specific law about Pesach. It's a general law about Yom Tov. However, it says that if it's Shabbos, right, if it's Shabbat, then you are allowed to invite a non-Jew because you're not allowed to cook anyway. So therefore, you're not going to be cooking any extra for them. Everything was already cooked before. So if the Seder night comes on Friday night, then you are allowed to have, you're allowed to invite a non-Jew at your Seder. If it comes out during the week, you're allowed to serve them if they come. But the problem with inviting them is that we're afraid you may actually cook extra for them, and that would be a problem. Okay, so I hope you learned something, even if you didn't believe in these myths, but hopefully you learned something from this class, and I thank you all for coming. I am selling my book. It's called The Practical Parsha. It is one article on Jewish law relating to the Torah portion of every week, and I also send out a weekly email on that same theme, but it's not in the book. It's actually part of the next book, so if you want to sign up for that, there's a sign-up sheet on the table over there as well.